Hello. In this audio snippet, we're going to continue talking about the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse and all the things that are around it. And we're going to continue with a story that was posted shortly after the collapse of the bridge. And I still have difficulty understanding the full significance of this story, but we'll share what the story is about and share a few thoughts that come to my mind. But I feel like the fullness of it is still not in my understanding at present. The story was posted in several places, including the New York Post, on the 27th of March, 2024. So it was the day after the collapse. And the headline says, construction worker escaped Baltimore Key Bridge collapse after last-minute shift change. And, quote, "I give thanks to God," unquote. So, it says here, a Baltimore construction worker who would have been on the Francis Scott Key Bridge if not for a last-minute shift change is mourning his colleagues who died when the structure collapsed. Moises Diaz, or Diath, with a Z at the end, so the correct pronunciation would be Moises Diaz, 45, of Broader Builders, is grieving for the men he viewed as family, while also counting his blessings after avoiding the disaster, he told the Post in an exclusive interview Wednesday. Quote, "If I didn't ask to switch, I would have been in the water right now," unquote, Diaz said through a translator. Then there's a picture of him, and I'll share a little bit of my thoughts on what I see in the picture, but I'll continue here. It says, quote, "It's tragic. I'm really appreciative that I wasn't on the bridge. I give thanks to God," unquote. Then it goes on to talk about the people who died, at least eight people. And it was actually eight people working on the bridge plunged into the Patapsco River when a massive shipping container lost power and barreled into the structure. And then it goes on to talk about other things in the story. And it mentions the four countries of the people involved who were on the bridge at the time of the collapse, and they're all Hispanic countries. But I'm not going to mention them by name. They're not worthy of being mentioned. And the interesting thing is that the nationality of this Moises Diaz is not mentioned. I didn't find it anywhere. It might be somewhere, but I didn't find it, and it's not in this article either. But I get the feeling of, by looking at his face, I kind of get a sense of what country, which of the four countries he might be from, but I could be wrong. Now, the thing that that I get from this, and the reason I feel uncomfortable even sharing this story, I don't know why, but what drew my attention is the name of the fellow, Moises, which is the Spanish form of Moses, or Moshe in Hebrew, Moses, and his surname is Diaz, D-I-A-Z, Hispanics don't pronounce the Z correctly, in Spain or Spanish, Spanish spoken by the people of Spain. The Z has like a sound similar to the TH in English. And the soft C also has a similar sound. So that's why you say Barcelona instead of Barcelona. It's Barcelona. And same thing with this, but it, what I'm trying to say is that that Hispanics don't pronounce the Z correctly, so they pronounce it like an S, So they would say Moises Diaz. And when you say it like that, Diaz is the same thing as literally, if you change the Z to an S, that literally means days in Spanish. So Moises Diaz, if you pronounce it the way a Hispanic would, Moises Diaz, then it says Moses days. So you could it's as if the name says the days of Moses. And this I find this very fitting because we may have shared on this before, but there's a contrast between Moses and Joshua. Moses in the Bible died in the wilderness without entering the promised land. Joshua did live through the wilderness adventure and entered into the promised land. So it's a figure of two types of people, people who when you project it to the phases that we've talked about, the white phase, the red phase, there's a black phase, and then there's a green phase. If you project it that way, Moses kind of corresponds with people who get trapped or caught in the black phase, and Joshua represents people who enter into the green phase, people who cross the Jordan and break on through to the other side, as the song would say. The fact that this survivor is called kind of has the connotation of the days of Moses. And days of Moses, if you pronounce it as a Hispanic would, not as with a proper Spanish pronunciation, it just gives this connotation that that's what America turned into. The days of America turned into the days of Moses. These were the times of Moses, and America chose to stay in the times of Moses. And that's why it never crossed the River Jordan and never broke on through to the other side. And so it's kind of fitting also that this is all in the context of a collapse of a bridge that would take you from one side of a river to another. So that's what happened to America. America was never able to cross the bridge to the other side because it lived in the days of Moses, and it thought it could complete its purpose and enter into its promised land even whilst remaining a Moses. And the sad thing is not just a Moses, a Hispanic Moses at that. It wasn't Moses days, it was Moises Diaz. That just kind of shows how America not only died as a Moses, but it died as a Hispanic Moses, just like Latin America died 20 years earlier. That's what I see in that. Now, the thing is, he says he thanks God and everything, but what bothers me about the story, it just gnaws at me for some reason, is that it talks about a last minute shift change. And then I said to myself, okay, when I read that at the beginning, the first time, I said, okay, did they switch him with someone else? Like, did the people who assign the shifts, the manager, foreman, or whatever he's called, did he decide, he or she or whoever decide, okay, we're gonna take Moises Diaz out and put in whosoever else. But then later on in this article, they quote him saying, "If I didn't ask to switch, I would have been in the water right now." So he was the one who asked for the switch. It wasn't some manager who decided for him. And I go, okay, and I'm just, I don't know, it gnaws at me. Why did he ask for the switch? And I try to find something online that would clarify that, but no one explains that. There's at least nothing that I found. They explained a whole bunch of stuff about him and how he talked to the family of one of the survivors and all this stuff. They say all these things, but no one bothered to ask him, why did you switch? or if they asked him, they didn't bother to write it down. And I find that very, very interesting. Why no one, because it would be like a very interesting human interest story. Something, you know, that talks about like the circumstances of life and how you do, you make one decision because this, that, or the other happened, and then that changed the course of your life, so forth. It's an interesting, sorry for the redundancy, but interesting human interest story. I mean, if I were a reporter, that'd be the first question I'd ask him after him, after hearing him say, if I didn't ask to switch, then I said, why did you switch, by the way? And I wouldn't be surprised if someone did ask him, and then the answer was not, didn't fit the narrative, or the answer was not quite the wonderful human interest story that you would expect, and that's why they didn't report it. But so did he say that he was sick, or and when he wasn't, or did he, was he tired, was he late, did he get up late, and that's why he said, oh, I'm not gonna make it in time because I woke up late, and so I'm asking for the switch? We'll never know. Well, we'll know someday, I guess, but in a sense, but at least for now, we don't know, or I don't know why he did that. And then the other thing that bothers me is, did he ask for a switch with someone else? Did he say, okay, did he ask one of the other co-workers, hey, do you want to switch with me? I'll work your shift and you'll work mine. I don't know. So if that was the case, then he basically sent the other guy to his death. But I don't know. Or maybe he was just changed to another shift, so he would that he didn't switch with another person. He just switched shifts, if that makes sense. So there's a lot of, like, I don't know why it just bothers me to no end. Like, there's something incomplete there. But it's as if he was allowed to survive just so that his name would be connected to this bridge. A man who made a last-minute change and could have died but didn't. And this is his name, and he will forever be associated to this collapse of this bridge in Baltimore. The Days of Moses. That's what his name means when you pronounce his surname the way a Hispanic would. That's one thing that draws my attention. And, you know, he thanks God and all that. But what bothers me, aside from all of that, is when they say, I'll repeat the sentence. If I didn't ask to switch, I would have been in the water right now, unquote, Diaz said through a translator. That bothers me to no end. And the dude is 45. So he said through a translator. Doesn't that tell you how, you know, the sad state of the country, the bridge that represents America, the national anthem, and all this, and then the one person who survives because he made the last minute shift is a guy who was grateful that he wasn't there and is explaining all of this through a translator. In other words, he doesn't even speak English, and he's working on, in other words, he wouldn't be able to sing the national anthem if his life depended on it. And that's the fellow that will be permanently associated to a bridge named after a man who wrote the words for the national anthem. I hope you see the irony in that. And then he goes on to talk about, you know, grieving the other man, and that they were family, and this and that, the other. And I don't know if it says it here in this story or another story that I saw. Oh, yeah, here it is. There were good people, Dieth said of the workers. And then I don't know if it says it here, but there's a place I saw where he says they were all good citizens. Oh, here it is. They were good citizens. They were good workers, hardworking. They were good family members, husbands and dads, unquote. So he called them good citizens. And I can only wonder if they really were citizens. Was he using the word citizens like in a very generic, like citizens of the world kind of thing? Or was he really meaning that they were good American citizens? I don't think they were citizens, to be frank. Especially him, you know, given that he can't even speak the language. He's at age 45. Who knows how long he's been in the country. I don't know. There's like, why is he not speaking English? It's bothersome. And so I wanted to mention that. And I did also want to say, when I looked at the picture of him, he's kind of he looks like a short, stocky type fellow. When I see his face, yeah, he might be a nice person, and I say that in quotes. But what I see in him, and I've seen such faces in Hispanics before, is the sort of man who just, how can I explain it? Who just goes through life kind of rumbling along without really, really thinking that there's something he needs to change about himself. It's like he's been accumulating a few good things or supposedly good ideas in his heart and mind about how to live your life. You know, he picks a thing here, he picks a thing there. And it's now his basket of good things to live by is full. And he's now just, you know, like a tank, just going forward with that bag of what he thinks are the keys to living a good life. And he looks at his bag every day, and he's proud of his bag, and it makes him feel like a good person, and validates him and makes him feel like, yeah, I don't need to change anything because I have a bag of lots of good things. And I'm not saying this just to fit with what I'm about to say after this. I'm just saying that that's exactly what I perceive when I see his face. And apparently he must be some sort of quote Christian. And I'm not questioning the sincerity of that. He surely must believe in God, and he points, makes an effort to thank God for the last minute switch, which we will never know the reason behind it. And it bothers me. I don't know. It just keeps gnawing at me. Why did he do the switch? And if I was thanking God, I would have said, you know, something like, I had a dream the night before, and I saw this, and I felt this warning from God not to go to work that day. You know, that would have added to, you know, like a testimony of the reality of the God I believe in, or something like that. But I just get the feeling that this last minute switch or shift change that he asked for. It was not, see, if it had been imposed on him, then it's like a different story. Then yes, it there seems some sort of providence, like that God said, okay, he's a good man, I'm gonna let him live, and the other ones are not that good, so they're on their own, but I'm gonna spare this one. But he was the one who asked for it, and that's why it keeps prompting me to ask why did you ask for that shift change? I wonder, I think that there must be a very, very non elegant or non fairy tale type, or I don't know how to explain it, non poetic or magical answer to that. It's like there's something like he maybe overslept or went out to party the night before and was a little hungover, and that's why he didn't want to go to work that day and ask for the switch, and it was granted to him because there was no urgency in filling all the potholes and they had enough workers or whatever. Who knows? But there's something there. But the thing is, he will be permanently associated to this bridge. A Hispanic guy who can't even speak the language, who could not sing the national anthem if his life depended on it. And his name means Days of Moses, the days of Hispanic Moses. And that's the days in which, during which America died. And the other thing, I don't know if I have it on screen here, but somewhere I did read that that the people on the bridge were there. They had finished filling the potholes, and they were waiting for the potholes to dry before reopening the lanes. And they were, you know, eating, drinking coffee, and maybe eating a sandwich or whatever, waiting for the holes, you know, the cement or whatever, or the asphalt, whatever they put in the potholes, to dry, so that they can reopen the lanes and continue working. And I don't know, that makes me think a lot of things. Had this guy been on the shift, would they have been able to finish filling the potholes more quickly? And maybe they wouldn't have had to wait longer for the asphalt or whatever to dry. And they might have been able to be all of them be off the bridge. I don't know. Maybe I'm just speculating. Maybe that's not a realistic scenario where, you know, that had it been working there, that would have accelerated their work and allowed them to get off the bridge before the collapse. I don't know. Maybe that's just exaggerating. Maybe asphalt doesn't dry that fast. But aside from that, it also kind of shows the futility of what conservatives are always trying to do. 'Cause, yeah, you're filling potholes in a bridge that's about to collapse. Do you see I don't know if I'm making sense about the radical futility of that type of work. And that's what conservatives were constantly doing, trying to fill the potholes of the Constitution, of a system, filling the potholes of a system that is going to collapse anyway. You know, it's like, you know, the old saying of rearranging the decks of the deck chairs of the Titanic. You know, what's the point of rearranging the deck chairs or tidying up the ship? The ship is going to go under, you know, in a few minutes. And the same thing happened with this bridge. They were filling the potholes and thought, okay, we're good to go. And then the whole system was brought down. The whole bridge, in this case, which is a figure of the American system. But so I think that this guy's personality, what I was saying about the that he has a basket. I see him. Like, he has a basket, and he's going around grabbing things here and there and says, this is how you live a good life. These are the attitudes that make you a good person. And that's why he uses that phrase, like, good citizen. So he's trying to be a good person and trying to, in his own understanding of what good means. And he's putting things into a basket and says, okay, now I have the basket. This is what makes me a good person. I can live, go on with my life. And that's the same thing conservatives are constantly doing. It's like, okay, if we put do this, and do this, and we have a country that upholds these values, X, Y, and Z values, then we're a good country and we're good to go. And we don't need anything else. Thank you very much. Our basket is full. And he represents that. That same mindset, and that's part of why he will be permanently tied to this bridge. That's all I can say. Maybe I'm wrong about him, but just the name alone just certifies to me that he represents he's not a symbol of how can I say it. Of greatness or some wonderful silver lining in this in an otherwise tragic story. He is part of the dark cloud. His name, everything that he embodies, is a dark cloud that adds to the darkness of the story, if you see what I'm saying, instead of putting a silver lining to this tragedy, as people call it. Because, as I said, he couldn't even sing the national anthem if his life depended on it. It's like if somebody said to him, "Sing the national anthem or you'll go down with the bridge," he would go down with the bridge because he can't even mouth the words in English. So we wanted to mention that. Now that we've said that, let's move on to some more details, and now going into the connection to Singapore that this ship had. So for that, I'm going to go to a story that I found. I wasn't looking for this story kind of in a particular way. I was doing a generic search, and I found this story, and it draws my attention that when I started reading it, I slowly realized that it was actually a story on a Christian website. Let me see if I can. Okay, here it is. But I didn't know it at the time because I was looking for information related to the bridge collapse, so and the ship itself. And the website is hisglory.me, HISGLORY.ME. Not sure what the ME stands for. Usually domain names end in .com or .org or .info or .net and so forth, but this one ends in .me. Which I don't know, find that very peculiar. I don't know what that means. So hisglory.me. So this website, which apparently is a Christian website, says, okay, so the headline, this article was, I don't see a date here. But it was posted shortly after the collapse of the bridge, so it must have been around the end of March of 2024, and the headline reads, "The ship that brought down Baltimore's Key Bridge has a troubling past." So it says here, and this story was written by George C. Upper the Third. Upper, as in upper school or upper room or upper class. George C. Instead of George C. Scott, it's George C. Upper the Third. So if you pronounce the C and the upper together, it's George Cupper the Third. I don't know why I had to say that. Okay, so the story begins, "The companies that own and operate the container ship that brought down the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore have been in trouble before, and so has the ship. According to WDCW, I guess that's either a television or radio station in DC, I imagine. According to WDCW, the MS Dolly, Dali, damaged a quay, I don't know how to pronounce Quay. I apologize, I'm a bit ignorant on that. Wall in a collision on July 11th, 2016, at the port of Antwerp in Belgium. I did not know that, and to be frank, I had not noticed that until I'm reading it right now, until me reading it, rereading this story right now. I knew that we had talked about some inspection issue that happened with the ship in Antwerp, Belgium. But I didn't realize that the ship had actually done some physical damage to a wall over in Antwerp, in Belgium. It just emphasizes the connection to this American-Belgium thing that we were talking about. So it was more than just the an inspection failure. It actually damaged something in Belgium. And then it came and damaged something here in America. Over there, it just damaged a wall. Here, it just brought down the whole bridge. As we said before, America, Europe has a Belgium. America is a Belgium. And we said this 17 years ago. around 17 years ago, as you may recall, when we were talking about that, we read from an article posted on the website where these recordings are posted. Okay, so it says here that quote, that 2016 incident occurred as the Dali was leaving port in Antwerp and struck a loading pier made of stone, causing damage to the ship's stern, according to VesselFinder.com, a site that tracks ships across the world, unquote, USA Today reported Tuesday. Quote, an investigation determined a mistake made by the ship's master and pilot was to blame, unquote. The outlet that the ship had to be repaired, the outlet said, I guess there's some typo here. The outlet said that the ship had to be repaired and inspected after the accident. Quote, after an accident, an investigation will always be conducted by independent experts to determine the damage, unquote. Elke Verbellen, I'm not sure how you pronounce that, spokeswoman for the Port of Antwerp told WDCW in an email. In this case, it was conducted by the Nautical Commission, unquote. Verbellen said the Dali would have been prevented from leaving the port after the accident until, quote, experts have determined that it can sail safely, unquote, as would be the case in any such event. The pier was also, quote, seriously damaged, unquote, USA Today added, and was closed as a result. At the time, the Dali had been chartered by Maersk. And again, I don't know how to pronounce that. It's Maersk. I think that's how I've heard it pronounced, I think. It's a Danish company. It was also being chartered by Maersk at the time of the Baltimore accident, the outlet reported, citing information from VesselFinder.com, a ship tracking website. Quote, we're deeply concerned by this incident and are closely monitoring the situation, unquote, Maersk said in a statement to USA Today. WDCW uncovered a number of lawsuits against Synergy Marine, the operator of the Dali, and Grace Ocean Private Limited, which owns it. Okay, so Maersk is the one who charters the ship. I'm not quite sure what that means, but whatever it means, there's the connection. Like in a sense, the Danish are overseeing the ship in some way. And then the operator, that's like a second entity here, is Synergy Marine. Synergy, like the word Synergy Marine. That's the operator. And then there's an owner, that's the third entity, Grace Ocean Private Limited. Grace Ocean Private Limited. When I looked at that the first time, I said, Grace Ocean. The first thing that struck me was the word grace. Grace as in, the literal word grace, Grace. Grace Ocean Private. But the second thing that drew my attention is interesting. I said, Grace is G, Ocean is O, and Private is P. So Grace Ocean Private, the acronym would be GOP. I said, oh, very interesting, because that's the way people refer to the Republican Party here in America, the Grand Old Party, the GOP. And so they have the same initials, and I know that's not a coincidence. Now, both companies, Synergy Marine and Grace Ocean Private, it says here, are based in Singapore, the outlet noted. And that's where the Singapore connection starts coming in. It says here, Maryland officials said the Dali ship bound for a week-long voyage to Singapore lost power and slammed into the bridge around 1:30 a.m., sending vehicles and pieces of the bridge into the water below. Unquote. All right, so two lawsuits were filed in 2019 by men allegedly injured on the ship. One of them claimed that a rope ladder, quote, snapped, resulting in a worker receiving several broken bones. In the other, another man said that a hatch opening earlier that it should have resulted in injuries. And that the rope ladder snapping kind of drew my attention because it reminded me of something I saw like in a very brief vision 4 days before the bridge collapsed. And it was like a suspension bridge, and what I saw was like these the cables of the suspension bridge kind of snapping off. Like there was some sort of, I don't know if it was an earthquake or something, but the bridge was being destroyed. And as the bridge was destroyed, I only saw the columns kind of remaining. So the bridge didn't completely collapse. It just the collapse. I mean, the bridge did not completely disintegrate, but it had some columns left. But the bridge itself, where the cars would go, that was completely destroyed. So the bridge became unusable. But I saw what I saw, and that was like the snapping of the cables, like pop, pop, pop. It was starting to snap off, and the bridge became, it was destroyed, but the columns were left standing. But damaged, all kind of like damaged. They were like made of stone, of some sort of like stone substance. But it was not hard stone. It was like stone that could be kind of carved off somehow. So it was like left all damaged, but but the columns were left all damaged. They were still standing, but they looked bad, and the bridge was gone for all intents, for all practical purposes. So I found it interesting, and that this was 4 days before this this bridge collapse. But the thing is that that rope ladder snapping reminded me of that, and I'm not sure what the connection is and all that. But then it says here, 2 years later in 2021, a Georgia longshoreman filed a third suit over a handrail that collapsed. All three suits were settled, according to the outlet, which offered no comment as to whether the number of claims involving the dolly was unusual for a ship of its size and activity. A fourth suit involving a Texas port worker allegedly being, quote, pinned under some metal pipes, unquote, was reportedly dismissed, according to WDCW. So the ship had issues, and that kind of points to several things. First, like there were problems with America before the whole thing collapsed. It was not like a sudden thing where no one knew, and we were being warned and warned and warned again, over and over again, that there were problems. There were problems, but we just kept looking as collectively, as a people. We kept looking the other way, pretending like it wasn't there. And that's exactly what the GOP is doing all the time. The Republicans are always saying, "No, it's let's look the other way." Like, just to give you a quick example, recently, Bite Me has decided to pardon whole hundreds of millions of dollars of student debt. People who borrow money from the federal government to pay these over the top expensive university tuitions here in America that have just skyrocketed beyond any realistic value. And so people have been going, going to university, graduating, but they pile up this incredible amount of student debt, and they have to pay it off for the rest of their lives, basically. And now Bite Me, who is trying to buy votes, is just unilaterally pardoning debts. You don't have to pay it anymore. And I'm saying that as an example, like, you would go, how can the executive branch decide that? That's not their decision to make. But it's because of the fact that we have a very poorly defined system where the branches of government are not clearly delimited by the Constitution. Oh, you're saying, oh, well, in the founding fathers did not give the president the power to do that. Well, yeah, the founding fathers didn't give the president diddly squat of power in the Constitution. There's so little, clearly defined there that if a president just were operated by what the Constitution defines, he would be just a figurehead. I mean, that's all he would be, nothing more. There's very little power, because even Washington, from the very first founding fathers, from the first few presidents, including founding fathers like Madison and so forth, they all did lots of things that were not explicitly in the Constitution, because there's no practical boundary. Now, and why, if you say the Constitution is the one that allows these things, or that does not allow these things, why aren't there lawsuits being filed to prevent this? And this has been going on for a long time, even from before. So it's not like Bite Me is the first one who is overreaching the boundaries of the executive branch, or at least at least from the perspective of someone who's saying, oh, that's wrong, not from the Constitution, because the Constitution doesn't really say what is or isn't. It's just this ambiguous thing. But we've been having this problem. Why can't a lawsuit be filed if the Constitution clearly says that he cannot do that? Why can't a lawsuit be filed and be won? Why isn't it straightforward? Because it's so ambiguous, no one really knows. And also, you could say the Constitution, in a sense, does give that power, because the Constitution says that people can be, the president can unilaterally forgive someone, pardon a person from a crime, which is a stupid, stupid idea. I've always found that to be a very, very dangerous and stupid idea. So you can take an extension of that and say, okay, yeah, the Constitution therefore allows him to forgive someone of their debt, because if they don't pay the debt, they would be liable legally, and he is absolving them from that legal liability, just as he would pardon a criminal or murderer or rapist or whatever. It's what I'm saying is, the other thing is, technically he's not violating anything in the Constitution, because someone would say, well, only the Congress can allocate money. Well, yeah, the money was allocated by Congress to provide for these over-the-top student loans, to pay these exorbitant tuition fees. The money was already allocated. He's not spending more money. He's not allocating money to be spent. He's just pardoning debt, saying, you don't have to pay us back, which is technically not a violation of the Constitution. So what we're saying is, all these things are clear signs that there's something broken in the system, completely broken. And also, we've been having over-the-top tuition fees rising since the 1980s. I remember when I went to, had the blessing of going to university, yeah, it was always expensive, but it was never even close to what it is now. I mean, even if you account for inflation, it has gone skyrocketed just exorbitantly. And I've seen that, and I go, there's something wrong with the system. And what's going on is, when the government started getting involved in student loans and handing out all this money, what happened was that the university saw, oh, the government's giving out money for loans, so now we can jack up the prices, because now they can pay for it. They just have to take out a loan for it. And yeah, they will have to pay it back someday, but that's not our problem. So they just started increasing the prices of their education, because they said, oh yeah, the government is going to give them the loans that they need to pay these exorbitant rates, so we're just going to increase the rates. So they increased the fees, and that just led to this spiral because people kept paying the higher fees. The universities would raise the fees even more, and they would just, the people would just go to take out more loan, you know, more bigger loans from the government. The government kept handing them out, and it just spiraled out of control. Instead of somebody standing up and saying, hey, the problem here is not that the people are not being lent enough money. The problem is that the universities are charging too much. And the Democrats had no problem with that, because most of the universities are just liberal hellholes. And to them, you know, it's like paying back, because they're educating all these people to hate to hate liberty, to hate so many things. So to them, the Democrats are recompensing, rewarding these institutions for their indoctrination. And also, because these are all Democrats, then these people have more money, and now they can donate more money to the Democrat Party. So to them, the Democrats don't see it as a problem. And yeah, these high fees, well, we'll just guarantee that we'll be issuing higher student loans, more and more money to be lent to people. And so the cycle just gets created. So the Democrats have no problem with that. But Republicans should have seen this as a problem all along and said, let's make a public call to curtail university fees. We cannot have it like that. And then shame these elitists who are constantly talking about the rich and the elite, and they themselves are getting rich off of the poor students. So they could have taken this and turned it into a talking point, into a powerful point to point out the hypocrisy of these socialist elitists who are constantly demanding wealth redistribution, but are paying themselves millions and millions of dollars, enjoying the wealth that comes from borrowed money that other people have to borrow and pay for the rest of their lives. So they could have used this as a way to I'm not a believer in caps and in price controls, but given the circumstances, given that the hypocrisy and all the demagoguery that goes around the student loans, that the government must hand out, give people of color and whatever minorities the opportunity for a higher education, so they just keep promoting that. And if you speak out against it, then you're against black people getting educated, or Hispanics, or whatever the hell ethnicity you want to mention, getting educated. So to get around that, I would say, okay, let's pass a law that says no university can charge more than $8,000 or $10,000 a year. And we'll only give out loans to universities that honor that cap. Or we can say, there's a university that wants to charge more, then we'll only give you up to $10,000 because we want to put a cap on that. Or you could even technically pass a law and say, no university can charge more than $10,000 of tuition per year. Imagine that. And who's going to complain about that? Oh, well, the elitists, and then you can call them out. My point is, there was a problem. Universities were getting greedy, exploiting the system that was opening the public coffers for them through these over the top, these ridiculous student loans, and the GOP could have used this to deal with the root issue and cap it, but they never did. This has been happening for the last 30, 40 years, and now they're complaining that Bite Me is pardoning the debt, and then the rest of the taxpayers all have to pay the bill. And so we are paying for all these wealthy elites to have millions of dollars in these over the top overrated universities who are indoctrinating all these young people with all this nonsense. So yeah, now the GOP complains, but why didn't they deal with the root issue all along? It's this constant idea. So we've been warned through all these things and being forced to question what is the root problem, what is causing all of this. And instead of that, we just keep pretending like nothing happened, So the disasters get bigger and bigger. And this ship is a figure of that. They had the issues, the problem, they hit that wall in Antwerp, in Belgium. And then it started having, issues with somebody getting broken bones because some rope ladder snapped. and so forth. And I know that what snapped here was not some sort of cable, it was a rope ladder. But as you, I hope you see that you know, there's a similarity there with what I was saying about that bridge that I saw 4 days before this bridge collapse. And I was sharing that with someone at the time. But I when I heard about this story about the bridge in Baltimore, I said, oh, interesting. But it was somehow different because, in a sense, this bridge collapsed completely, the Baltimore Bridge. And the one that I saw in this vision was a little, kind of remained, the structures kind of remained, but the bridge itself was gone. Okay, so now let's talk a little bit about about the connection to Singapore. Synergy Marine and Grace Ocean Private Limited. So we saw the Grace Ocean Private Limited kind of pointing to the GOP, the one that the Do Nothing Party, the party that says we just have to get the government out of the way, just do nothing, and everything will work out on its own. You know, the Do Nothing Party. The Do Nothing Party is the party that never deals with the root issues, never gets to the core of the problem, and is never willing to deal with foundational structural issues because they are so in love with the founders that it's sacrilege to even go there for them. But Synergy Marine, Synergy, what does that tell you? What does that convey? It conveys harmony, synergy, getting along, you know, all working together towards a common goal. It's that matriarchal mindset, the server and organizer mindset of, you know, let's all get along, let's work together, we're a community, and blah, 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 blah. So it's that matriarchal understanding of the world in a negative sense. There's nothing wrong with synergy itself, in and of itself, but I'm saying in a negative context, that's what conveys, because the people who talk the most about community and uniting and together we can make it happen and let's all work together to for the common goal and let's save the planet and let's save the whales and all this, that's matriarchal mindset. And it's trying to merge people's identities into a collective and destroying the individuality of people. The true synergy, the righteous synergy, is the synergy where you maintain your individuality, and even as you maintain that individuality, you can work in harmony with other individuals. That's what creates true synergy, the synergy that changes the world. The other synergy is just a drone mentality, where everybody just becomes a drone. You know, like in the Matrix films, you just become one of the many who dresses the same and is controlled by the Matrix, just acting, just living life without thinking. You're just following orders and instructions. And that's the false synergy. And then in the other entity, the one that owns the ship, Grace Ocean Private, the word Grace jumped at me, and it kind of certified something that was in my head every time I would see Singapore. Because every time I think of Singapore, the face that pops up in my head is of a man called Joseph Prince. And you may or may not have heard of him, but he is a very well-known, at least in, you know, in many circles, Christian, and I say that in quotes, Christian preacher in Singapore. And he has this mega church, very popular. And when I'm flipping through the channels on television, I get TBN every now and then. And sometimes I flip through and I've seen him. Sometimes on Sunday, I'm flipping through the channels and I when I go through TBN, I see him showing up, and he's very well known in America. Even though he's from Singapore, he's oriental looking, and And that's the person who comes to my mind when I think of Singapore all the time. You say Singapore, next thing I think of is Joseph Prince. And oh, by the way, before talking about him, I do have to say this, that the fact that the Grace Ocean Private owns the ship is a figure of how the GOP and conservatism in America owns the disaster of this country dying. Even though the disaster was operated by the liberals. You see, the Synergy Marine represents the Democrats, the crowd or mob mentality of the collective. And then Grace Ocean Private, even the word private makes you think of an individual. So it's more like the conservative, like the standalone, you know, rugged individualist conservative. So Synergy Marine represents the Democrats, and Grace Ocean Private represents the Republicans or the conservatives. And Grace Ocean Private owns the ship. And this is if the truth is saying, you conservatives, you own this disaster. This is on you. Even though the disaster was operated by Synergy Marine, in other words, by the Democrats or the liberals, the disaster was carried out or operated by the liberals. They are the ones doing the literal destruction of the country. But who owns that disaster destruction? The conservatives. Why? Because the conservatives were the ones who had access to the truth and decided to stay in their conservative ways. And if they had listened to the truth, things would have changed. And that's why they are responsible. In the eyes of the truth, the ones who own this disaster are conservatives in America. Okay, so now... So I mentioned the thing about Joseph Prince in Singapore. Now, Singapore is a place of very subtle but very real religious oppression. And it sounds like a contradiction because I just mentioned that Joseph Prince is one of several people in Singapore that have, you know, with mega churches. Very popular, very wealthy, very prosperous, and so popular. His messages are so interesting. A lot of, quote, American Christians find his messages so interesting that he's toured America, and he's on TBN, as I said, which is an American Christian broadcasting network. And he's there all the time. And everybody who watches those shows is very much aware of him. He's a popular guy in Christian circles, including conservative circles. So you say, well, how can, if Singapore is a place of religious oppression, how can this guy be thriving in Singapore? Well, see, the thing is, to get a sense of that, let me share with you this comment or this thing that was written on Wikipedia, and let me see if I can find it. Yes, here it is. So the article is called Freedom of Religion in Singapore. It's a Wikipedia article. So it's a Wikipedia article specific to religion in Singapore, and it's called Freedom of Religion in Singapore. And it has a section, at least at the time of this recording, because obviously the Wikipedia articles are edited every now and then, so this may or may not be the same when you hear this audio snippet, if you hear it later on. But at the time of this recording, there's a section here called Notable Incidents. So in that section called Notable Incidents, it says here, comments on Buddhism and Taoism by Pastor Ronnie Tan. I don't know how he pronounces his name. In February 2010, online videos posted on the website of Lighthouse Evangelism of sermons by then senior pastor Ronnie Tan, who suggested that Buddhism and Taoism were satanic, that caused a public uproar in Singapore, prompting a visit by the government's internal security department. Tan swiftly pulled the videos off the website and met with Buddhist and Taoist leaders to offer a personal apology. Returning to the pulpit that weekend, Tan said that the church was, quote, in the process of eliminating all possible offensive recorded material, unquote, and urged church members, quote, not to circulate our past sermons, which may provoke religious sensitivity, unquote. So this is the pastor. I mean, he suggested that Buddhism and Taoism were not of God, that they were satanic. And then the government visited him shortly afterwards. When they found out, imagine that, government officials showing up at a church and saying, what did you just say? And obviously threatening to shut him down. And then Ronnie Tan, being the brave matriarchal pastor that he was, immediately pulled back and said, I apologize for having offended anyone. I don't want it. And immediately he went, because he said, okay, my building. That's what he started thinking in his head, my church. And what is more important, my church or the truth of my words? And he waited to my church, obviously. So he backtracked on everything that he said, and he issued a personal apology. So in other words, yes, Christianity is based on a person who said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but except by me. That sounds a little bit exclusionary to me. There's no inclusivity there. It's like, it's his way or no way. That's what he's saying. Now that's what Christianity was founded on. And the thing is that you cannot, if you go to Islam, well, they say the same thing. They don't quite say it in the same words, but they kind of say, yeah, Allah is the one. It's not like Allah is just the flavor of the month or the flavor of the region. Like, oh yeah, that's what God decided to look like for the Arabs. You know, but he kind of morphs into Jesus for the Europeans, and he morphs into the God of Moses for the Jews. No. What I'm trying to say is that all the other, many other faiths say the same thing, and they have the same claim of exclusivity. Now, and if you're a Christian, I mean, you think of Buddhism and all the things that it says, and it's clearly incompatible. And if it's not compatible, then assuming Christianity is true, then Buddhism and all the stuff that it has is clearly incompatible with Christianity. And if it's not compatible with the true God, then it must be of the enemy. And the word for enemy in Hebrew, the word for enemy is Satan, Satan. That's where we get satanic. It means the enemy. And it's preaching something that is contrary to what I'm believing. So if you're going to be consistent, that's what I'm saying. Whether you believe in Christianity or not, if you believe in Christianity, at least be consistent about it and say, okay, there's something wrong with these people believing these things. So what I'm saying is, from my perspective, what Ronnie Tan was, if he's really a Christian, then there should be no problem him saying that. But he decided, no, let's just all get along. I may be right, but I don't want to offend. See, if I am right, if I'm a Christian and I'm right, and all these Buddhists are believing all this nonsense, then aren't they going to go to hell and burn in hell? Wouldn't I want to go and reach out to them and rescue them from, you know, before the building collapses, before the bridge collapses? But he's saying, no, let them all burn in hell. Let's just continue us here just singing and dancing and hoping that they by chance come into our little religious trap hole here, and we can catch them. But in the meantime, let's all get along. Let's say how wonderful they are, and we're all in these little bubbles, and they're the Buddhists here, the Taoists here, and the Christians here, and the Hindus or whatever the hell, all over the place, and let's just all get along. But this is the type of repression that you have in Singapore. And the reason is Singapore is a very harsh. I mean, it has a lot of economic freedom. It's like the equivalent of what we were saying before about Chile and Pinochet, Augusto Pinochet. Yes, a lot of economic freedom, laissez-faire economics, but all the government is all about controlling any sort of turmoil. So they're always concerned, because they have several religions there. They have Christianity, Buddhism. Let me see if I can find the list here. Let me see. Sorry, if I go to the Singapore Wikipedia article, it lists the religions there. 26% Buddhists, 25% no religion, 19% Christians, 14% Islam, 11% Hinduism, and 5% Taoism. So it's a lot of religions, and Buddhism being numero uno on the list, and Christianity a close third. So the government couldn't care less what religion you are, as long as you don't create unrest. That's what they want. They just want control. They want a stable government, and the government is I'm not quite sure how long, for example, the current president has been there. He may have I think he's been there for quite a while. Let me see if I can find this here. I should have seen this earlier, but let me see, who is the current president? Oh, and the other thing that they have is a mixture of different ethnicities. They have 74% of Chinese ethnic origin, around 13% Malay or from Malaysia, 9% Indian. So the thing is, it's a very diverse group of people, and the government is all about just keeping things stable, like no one causing too much trouble and creating rivalries or conflicts between groups. That's kind of what they're focused on. And if anyone does so much as anything to kind of stir any sort of conflict or turmoil, they just go in and shut it down. That's their mindset. The president who's there is actually of he looks Indian, and he's been there since 2023. So it's not he's been a dictator for a long time. But even so, the thing is that it's a very repressive system where you can't say anything, or you will get shut down by the government. Another example was in April 2017. I'm reading in the Wikipedia article again. Nala Mohammed Abdul Jamel, the chief imam at Jamia Chulia Mosque, for over 7 years, was fined $4,000 and repatriated to India after pleading guilty to promoting, to quote, promoting enmity between different groups on the grounds of religion, unquote, and committing an quote, act prejudicial to the maintenance of harmony, unquote. In a video circulated online, the imam recited a prayer in Arabic that said, quote, God help us against Jews and Christians, unquote, among other things, was circulated online. He later apologized to Jewish and Christian leaders in closed door meetings, saying that the additional supplication he read was not from the Quran, but an old Arabic text originating from his village in India. Okay. A statement by the Ministry of Home Affairs said the action was, quote, taken with some regret, unquote. It described the imam as having worked diligently, quote, attending to the needs of his congregation and reaching out to other faiths, unquote, and was not, quote, deliberately malicious, unquote. Two Muslim Koreans were issued stern warnings in connection with the incident. One man was warned for posting the video on Facebook instead of filing a police report. Another, a Malay Studies associate professor at the National University of Singapore, wrote a Facebook post that was seen to be made in support of the imam. Okay. There were another incident. Two foreign Christian preachers denied entry. In September 2017, the Ministry of Home Affairs said two foreign Christian preachers had been denied short-term work passes to speak in the country. The ministry did not name the preachers but said that they had made, quote, denigrating and inflammatory statements, comments of other religions, unquote, in the past. One of them was identified by the Straits Times as American preacher Dutch Sheets, who had allegedly described Allah as a, quote, false god and called for prayers for those, quote, held captive in the darkness of Islam, unquote. He also referred to Buddhists as Tohu, a Hebrew word meaning lost, lifeless, confused, and spiritually barren. Dutch Sheets, isn't it interesting? He makes another appearance again. Notice it's not a coincidence. I know it's not a coincidence. And we had spoken about him earlier in relation to the bridge, and how he surfaced on the news about the bridge and the vision he had had and all that. So now he appears again here in relation to Singapore. So he was denied entry because he had described Allah as a false god. Well, either he is or he isn't. If you believe in the Christian God, then Allah, the Allah of the of the followers of Meshuga that Allah is a false god. You can't have it. You can't have both. You can't have your cake and eat it too. So at least Dutch Sheets had he said it, and because he said it, he was denied entry. He also said that the Buddhists were Tohu, which means lost, lifeless, confused, and spiritually barren. Says the other unnamed preacher referred to, quote, the evils of Islam, unquote, and the, quote, malevolent nature of Islam and Muhammad, unquote. He called Islam, quote, not a religion of peace, unquote, and, quote, an incredibly confused religion, unquote, interested in, quote, world domination, unquote, and a, quote, religion based on adhering to uncompromising and cruel laws often focused on warfare and virtual slavery, unquote. And it says here, Home Affairs and Law Minister K, whatever the hell his name is, was quoted in local press reports as saying, quote, just as I have banned Muslim scholars or preachers from coming into Singapore, the most recent banning has been for Christian preachers. They were very Islamophobic in their statements outside of Singapore, and we decided we will ban them, unquote. So this is the environment. And there's another example here of, you can go on and on. I mean, they have two more examples, but I think it's too much to read. They banned someone who I'm trying to read here. Singapore banned Salafi preacher. So Salafi is that. That's a form of Sunni Islam. So it's an Islamic preacher, and he was banned because he described LGBT people as being, quote, worse than animals, unquote, and put forward the view that wishing non-Muslims Merry Christmas or Happy Deepavali was the highest form of blasphemy. And he had this previously described non-Muslims as deviant. You may or may not agree with him, but at least, you know, he's being consistent with what he believes. Misguided as he may or may not be, he at least is consistent. But you can't be consistent in Singapore. You can't. Because truth is conflictive and divisive, and they don't want truth. Truth is always divisive. If you say 2 + 2 = 4, you're going to anger every single idiot who thinks that 2 + 2 = 5. Oh, you're saying, well, no one thinks that 2 + 2 = 5. Well, I'm just giving an example of something that's obviously true so that you can see what I'm saying. But some things are not obviously true. And they are true, but they're not obvious. obviously true. And sometimes you say something that is true and becomes obvious when you think about it, but you'll always find someone who will not agree. Truth is always divisive. There was another person who was, I'll just mention him, an American preacher, Lou Engel, in March 2018. He went to this conference, 3-day conference in Cornerstone Community Church, one of the mega churches in Singapore. And he when he was there, he addressed thousands attending the conference, saying, "The Muslims are taking over the south of Spain, but I had a dream where I will raise up the church all over Spain to push back a new modern Muslim movement." That's all he said. And then the community church filed a police report against Rice Media, an online news startup that first reported the remarks. The church said the article was a scurrilous attack and that it had a seditious tendency. It also said the article contains serious allegations that seek to and has the effect of stirring up religious tensions and promoting feelings of ill will and hostility between Christians and Muslims. So they went after a news magazine that ratted them out. So that's the environment they're in Singapore. You say something controversial, someone's going to pick it up and publish it and tell the government, tell the people, "Hey, this place is saying this." So they filed a report against it to kind of like trying to nip it in the bud. But it was too late. So then it says, Yang Tuck Yung, senior pastor of the church, later said Eagle's remarks were, quote, "never meant to be an indictment against Muslims or the Muslim community in Spain as a whole." This is a Christian pastor speaking. Instead, he was referring to the radical Islamic insurgency, including ISIS, advances into that nation with intentions of pressing its brand of militant ideology. He expressed his apologies that the choice of words used might have caused unnecessary misunderstandings, as it had not been in his intention to do so, unquote. Engel did not comply with a request by the police department to return to Singapore to cooperate with investigations. Yang later met with the Mufti of Singapore and other Muslim community leaders to offer an apology. He said the church was unaware of Engel's controversial past and informed him that he would not be able to speak in Singapore in future. At an interfaith visit with the mosque months later, Yang said the church had tightened protocols and procedures to ensure, quote, "something like this never happens again." So next time they're going to, if they invite some American or some European preacher, they're going to go through his post online, his Facebook page, if the moron has one, and everything, just to make sure, and their video uploads. They have protocols in place now to filter out anyone who has in the past said something, because they know that if they let him in and they get associated with him, they're going to get shut down. And that's their fear. That's Singapore for you. I hope you're getting a sense of that's what's in that. That's the anointing, if you can call it that, or the aura that enveloped that ship as it rammed into that column that brought down the whole bridge, the Francis Scott Key Bridge. It's it represents this Christianity that is not, that avoids confrontation, that just wants to get along, because if they say something controversial, they will get shut down. And the thing is that the Christian church is incapable of speaking boldly because it always shuts down its own people. The people inside the church cannot say anything against the pastor, against the pastoral system. They cannot speak words of judgment on their own. It's not just the religious leaders, it's the people. They suppress their own people. Therefore, they don't have the power to speak to other people outside of their own environment, if you see what I'm saying. That's the matriarchal environment that the Christian American church is in, and the world in general, but especially in America, where Christianity was the strongest, you could say. The matriarchal Christianity just took hold and prevented people speaking in authority against unrighteousness in the church and outside the church. And that's all personified in Joseph Prince. Joseph Prince is a mess. He gives this message of prosperity, and he constantly speaks of grace. So that's why it's interesting that the company that owns the ship is called Grace Ocean Private. So he's just grace and grace and grace and grace. And that's all he talks about, grace, 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 and understanding he's against judgments. And I have it on good authority that this Joseph Prince at some point was made aware of the website where these recordings are posted by someone who goes to that church. This person went to Joseph Prince and told him about the ideas and the concepts on that website where these recordings are posted. And he said that website is not a good website, and there's no truth in it, because, you know, on that website we talk about the cursing of things, and he said that things cannot be that it's wrong. I'm quoting him, you know, or paraphrasing him. He said something to the effect of, "We Christians do not curse; we just bless. We are not in the business of cursing. We're in the business of blessing." Blessing, 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 blessing. So he became aware, he was exposed by the truth to the website and the concept of truth that he needed to understand in order to break out of his stupidity. But he chose not to, because he knew that if he embraced that, he would then be sentencing himself to death in Singapore. And he has made, and I also have this on good authority, that he has some sort of agreements with the government, and they let him speak with certain freedom, and they suppress others because he has all agreed that he is going to preach a message that is compatible with social harmony and social political stability, and because so he has sold himself for 30 pieces of silver to the Singaporean government. That's what Joseph Prince represents. That's what Singapore represents. That spirit or mindset of compromise, where you sacrifice your ability to speak with male authority, to pronounce things as they are, and not to be trapped in this matriarchal mindset. And by the way, cursed is Joseph Prince. Cursed are you for not embracing the truth. Cursed are you, and cursed is your church for not embracing the judgment personality, the visionary personality, and the conquest personality. You just want to get along. You have your little fiefdom, your little queendom, your little palace, and that's all you care about, nurturing your palace. But you have no interest of conquering your own country for the truth. You have no interest. Yeah, you have no problem having all the Buddhists burn in hell. You don't care about that. You don't care about the Muslims calling you swine and pigs. You have no problem with that. You just want to get along with everyone. And you don't believe that there's a supernatural God that could have transformed your country and could have broken through the barriers of division, and gone into the other people who are trapped and lost, and rescued them and conquered them for your God. You have no belief in that. Cursed are you because of that, because you're not consistent with your own God. And all you want is prosperity and peace and harmony and all the matriarchal nonsense. And that's why you are a preacher of failure. You're not a preacher of success. You're a preacher of failure. Yes, you have a big church, but that doesn't mean that you have succeeded. You are still a big failure. That's all you are. Bill Gates has a lot of money. That doesn't mean he's a success. That means you judge him not by how much money he has. You judge him by what he has produced. And he's a failure. And you are a failure. And you are going to stand before the truth. And you're going to be judged. And you're going to be cursed for all of eternity for your stupidity. And you're cursed now. Cursed are you, Joseph Prince, and cursed is everyone who promotes this matriarchal message of false tolerance, of false self-denying tolerance, of denying your own beliefs and your own values and suppressing yourself just to be in conformity and be the lapdog of the people in power. Cursed are you for promoting that mindset. And that's the mindset that the aura that was around that ship as it struck this column in the bridge in Baltimore and led to its collapse. That's why the Christian church was powerless to stop the destruction of the country, because it was full of Joseph Princes. Full of Joseph Princes. And then when some people arose to speak the word of truth, the American Christians shut them down immediately. And they didn't understand, because this is, see, the thing is, it's not about a militant like going out and killing people if they don't believe in you. If you believe in the truth, then you know that the truth transcends the natural. So you if you really believe it that things exist beyond the natural, you can wage the war at the higher level and win it. It's not a matter of going out and killing people and forcing people to believe in you. That's what liberals do. That's what the fascist white liberals in America do all the time, forcing their religion, which is their liberalism, on everybody. And they force it by law, and you have to comply, and you have to submit, and if you don't submit, we're going to punish you, just like the Singaporean people do, government does. No, it's a different type of thing. But it means confronting things at all levels. And it means confronting things within the same church system in America, which is crooked and decrepit. It's not just us Christians ganging up as a group as a church and an institution to overcome the other institutions. It's not like that. It's individuals judging and cursing what is right, what is wrong, and blessing what is right. Everywhere they go, no matter where they see it, whether they see it in their own Christian church or their own city or their own government or their own country, cursing what is wrong and blessing what is right and speaking in authority. And then truth eventually begins to pervade. It's like an unstoppable vapor of life that begins to just spread and fill the whole place. But it requires people who have the character to do it, to make it happen, to speak the truth. And not that the problem is when Christians start acting vocally, the matriarchal Christians, it's usually these trite messages, these very trite and simplistic messages. And that's why they have no power, and they only create many times conflict at the natural level, but they don't produce results at the spiritual level, at the metaphysical level, at the level that goes beyond the natural. And so we have a church system in America, conservatives, full of cowards, full of Joseph Princes, who want to reject judgments because they want to be liked. They want to be loved. And if you can't judge, you can't destroy what's wrong. If you don't destroy what's wrong, eventually what's wrong is going to destroy you. And that's what happened to the country. On Wikipedia, there's an article about Joseph Prince, and we're not going to go into too many details about him. By the way, he does have a mixture of the judge personality and the conqueror personality. But he only uses the judge personality to produce a quote wisdom that is interesting, but only geared towards a certain topic, which is the topic of grace. So he just misuses his wisdom to promote a message of grace. And then the ironic thing is, every time he says you should not judge people, isn't he judging people who are judging by saying you should not judge? He creates a message of, oh, we are to live by grace, and anyone who's not living by grace is wrong. Isn't that a judgment in and of itself? So he's wisdom always produces judgments. It's just producing these very twisted judgments, but in a very elegant way. And that's why people like to listen to him, because he seems to convince them with all his quote wisdom about all these things, but they're all twisted. But he has the wisdom or judge personality in him. It's just twisted. And he's also a conqueror. But he's conquering in the sense of conquering for his own congregation, conquering for his own ministry, his own church, and his own agenda, but not the truth's agenda. Oh, he says, oh, my agenda is the truth. No, it's not. No, it's not. No, it's not. Because the truth would want you to say certain things that you don't want to say. The truth always produces judgments, and you say there are no judgments. And by saying that, you are judging the people making judgments. You're a self-contradicting idiot. But by the way, and on Wikipedia, there's a page for him. It has like a publication section. And in that section, they mention one of the books he has. It's called Seven Keys to Freedom from Fear, Guilt, and Addiction. And then the other one is another one that he has. There's The Prayer of Protection, Living Fearlessly in Dangerous Times. And I find that so ironic. So two books written by him are about fear, or talk a lot about fear. Seven Keys to Freedom from Fear, Guilt, and Addiction. And then The Prayer of Protection, Living Fearlessly in Dangerous Times. Is he living fearlessly? Is he saying what needs to be said? Is he saying Allah is a false god? See, and the thing is, he doesn't even need to say it. He doesn't even need to say it. He just needs to speak with an authority that exudes that message. I don't know how to explain it. You don't have to go out and attacking Allah and the Buddhists. You don't have to do that. But when you speak with a certain spirit, a certain mindset, you're going to get the Allah lovers angry. Even if you don't say Allah a single time. And you're going to get the Buddhist fools angry, even if you don't mention Buddha a single time. You're going to ooze confrontation just by you speaking the truth. And then every now and then it's going to come out of you, out of your mouth, you know, what you think about the Meshuggah and his religion. And you're going to think, you're going to say something every now and then about what Buddha represents and the darkness that Buddhism, look at India. So many Buddhists, look at the darkness in India. Look at all the darkness of all the snake lovers, worshiping snakes, literally worshiping cows. I almost got hit by an Indian lady crossing the street here in New Jersey, in Hoboken, New Jersey. And I said to my, and I called her out on it, and I judged her, and I called her untouchable, and I cursed her because I saw the arrogance in her. When I called her out, instead of apologizing, say, I'm sorry, she got really angry. She gave me an angry stare, as if to say, how dare you talk to me like that? And I said to myself afterwards, interesting, because if I'd been a cow, she would have been completely distressed by the very thought that she might have hit me if I was a cow. But she it's not that she accidentally almost hit me. She knew that she was going to hit me, but I was crossing the street and I had the right of way, and I said, I'm going to cross the street because I have the right way. I saw her coming, and she saw me coming because there was nothing blocking the view. We clearly saw each other, but I said, I'm going to cross. And she got angry that I didn't yield to her getting on top of the crosswalk, if you see what I'm trying to say. I said, no, I'm not yielding. I'm on the crosswalk. I have the right of way. I have the light. I'm crossing. It's not like she was trying to beat the red light. The red light had turned red already for a while, and I was beginning to cross. And she saw me, and she thought I was going to stop and let her get in front of me, and I would have to go around her. Or maybe she was trying to blow the red light, who knows. But I didn't yield, and she almost hit me, and she got angry at me. And I said, interesting, if I had been a cow, she would have never even dared to try to, blow past me. So that's the irony, that's the darkness that Buddhism, Hinduism, and all that, brings to the world. Look at Nepal. Look at all these places where Buddhism and Hinduism, all these religions are, you know, there's no life. There's just despair and poverty, and that's all there is in those places of the world. Isolation, backwardness, all these things. So every now and then, if you speak the truth, you're going to say certain things, just like I'm doing right now, pointing out all these things. And I called, by the way, I called her this woman untouchable because I saw that she saw me with disdain, like I was from a lower caste, because I'm not 6 foot 4 and white and blonde, blue eyed, because they Indians tend to respect that. But if they see someone, because I'm, even though I am maybe 40% white, I don't look it. I'm darker skinned than I am, DNA wise, and I think there was a purpose for that. But the thing is that I sometimes the way Indian people treat me, I've always said I must look like what untouchables look like in India because they treat me with disdain. And on top of that, being a vertically challenged, it doesn't help. It's like they see me as something of a lower caste. And that's why I called her untouchable because it was my way of saying, "Hey, you are the one of a lower caste," and it was my way of calling out her discrimination, because now she can't get angry at me and say, "Oh, he's being discriminating," because I'm using a term that his her own culture created, and that her own culture very harshly applies in her own country and to her own people. Imagine how horrible it must be to be born into the untouchable class and to be called untouchable, that you're so disgusting, you can't, you don't, no one wants to touch you, unless it's another untouchable. Imagine that. And that even in the 21st century, they're still harboring that, even when there's no more apartheid in South Africa, and there's no more slavery in, anywhere in the world. They still do that to their own people. And I called her out on it. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is talk about the darkness in Buddhism and Hinduism. All these false imaginary philosophies that just trap people in these horrible holes of darkness. So if you're speaking truth, you're going to every now and then say something about it, just like I'm doing right now. You don't have to go constantly attacking. That's not the point. It's useless to do that. But the thing is that it's ironic that Joseph Prince writes books about living fearlessly when he lives and acts like a coward, like a lapdog to the Singaporean government, licking their feet every day. And then wiping his mouth with his paw to then bark a whole bunch of grace nonsense to people. That's the guy who's writing about living fearlessly. And this is not a personal attack. I couldn't care less about him. He's irrelevant in the scheme of humanity, except as a hindrance. He's irrelevant to me. I have no interest in him. But I'm pointing him out because that's what the ship is pointing out. That ship, every time I saw the connection to Singapore, I see Joseph Prince's face. And Joseph Prince represents all of this. So it's not just directed at Joseph Prince, it's everyone who is like Joseph Prince. And there are a whole bunch of them in America. So you're not alone, Joseph Prince. And that's why you're so popular here. And it's nothing against you because you rejected the website where these recordings are posted. You had an opportunity to change radically. It would have been a blessing to you, but you cursed yourself the moment. You cursed cursing. It's ironic. You cursed yourself the moment you cursed cursing. And that's what a lot of people in America do. But yeah, continue with their popularity. Americans love you here. So go ahead, continue with your popularity and continue being a coward, lapdog. I don't care. You will stand before the truth and you will be judged and you will understand that there were judgments after all. I don't give a damn about you. I could not care less. But I do have to say these things in the context of what destroyed this country. It's people like you who own the destruction of this country. You could have been a voice for change in America. Well, yeah, maybe you're too much of a coward to say the truth over in Singapore, but you could have at least come here and say it here. But yeah, you knew that maybe some Singaporean reporter would take notes and go tattletale on you back in Singapore, and then your church would be shut down. But don't you think that if your God is real, that your God would have then taken you and taken you all over the world to say the truth and expose the religious oppression in your own country, and you would have been an agent for freedom in your own land if you had had the courage to speak as you were supposed to speak. But cursed are you because you chose not to, and you claim to speak about fearlessness. You preach about it, but you don't live it. What a coward and a hypocrite. And by the way, maybe I should say this very quickly if I can find it. In the Wikipedia article on Joseph Prince, and again, this is not an attack on him. To be frank, I could not care less about the man. But he it says here, Prince was born in Singapore, the son of a Sikh, S-I-K-H, Sikh priest of Indian origin and a Chinese mother. So it says here he converted to Christianity at age 12. Prince studied at Commonwealth Secondary School and completed his A-levels at a private school, Our Lady of Lourdes. So it's like a Catholic school. So he has a Indian origin and on the father's side, and a Chinese origin on his mother's side. He looks Oriental. He looks Chinese. But so he could have had a calling to also be an agent of restoration for the people of India if he had spoken the truth. But it takes authority to speak the truth. And him being of Indian descent would have given him even greater authority to speak to the Indian people, to address them and confront them about the things that they're doing wrong. But he chose not to. So that's the connection to Singapore. And that's what why the bridge was owned and operated by Singapore companies. And just as a final note, and I think that would be the last thing we have to say about the bridge. Let me see if I can find it here. We wanted to quickly mention, we may have already talked about this, but we just wanted to emphasize it a bit. On the Daily Mail, on the 26th of March, that day that the bridge collapsed, they posted an article saying why did the Baltimore Bridge collapse so quickly? Engineers reveal how the flimsy structure came crashing down like a house of cards after being struck by the Dali container ship. What we wanted to emphasize is that it says here, when you take away one of the supports, you get a catastrophic failure because all those parts that are interconnected suddenly become overloaded, unquote, said one of the experts. And that's basically the nature of America, that, yeah, we were built, but it was like a flimsy structure that, yes, stood the test of time for a while because there was nothing harsh coming against it. But the moment something harsh came against it, it just created this very strong ripple effect, because everything was so interconnected that one thing led to another. And there's so many points of failure in the system, in the American system, that you hit one place hard enough and then you cause a collapse in the whole system. And it was, in a certain way, it's manifested in what happened in 1929 with the stock market crash. That system was inherently flawed, and it's still flawed. We still continue with the stock market system, and we've talked about that ad nauseum in previous recordings. And it took a certain set of events in 1929, and boom, the whole system collapsed because it was so dependent on these. It was so flimsy, the economic system, and the stock market system is so flimsily designed, so metaphysically flawed, that it took just one, bad sequence for the economy to just collapse completely, go from the roaring 20s into the depression 30s, from one extreme to the other. And we went into years of depression, of profound depression. And then we chose to elect a son of a bitch polio boy who ended up just deepening the depression by his policies. And then using the depression as an opportunity to institute a lot of the systems, that have contributed to our final collapse. All these socialistic institutions that were created, and now we have, I've lost count. I don't remember anymore how much debt, national debt we have. Is it 33 trillion? I don't know. And that all started because of that collapse of 1929. It's just one thing just creates this ripple effect. And the sad thing is, instead of correcting the problem, we just do it the same thing all over again. We never learned anything from 1929. We didn't learn a single thing, other than put a few band-aids here and there. And that's why and that's what this collapse represents, and conservatives keep defending this flimsy house of cards that is so vulnerable to so many things. Where you have to depend on people doing the right thing for the system to work. Instead of having a system that actually deals with issues and circumstances and deals with things from a metaphysical perspective, so that it's fundamentally sound. So even if something bad, unexpected happens, the system will still hold true, because truth is tougher than steel. It's like you can't break the truth. The truth is so inherently powerful, inherently consistent, that you strike it and you can't take it down. That's how strong the truth is. And if you build a system based on truth, then it will survive. It cannot be broken. But America decided, thank you very much. We don't want that. And the people who were bringing the message that was going to solidify and restructure and regenerate the system were the people that Joseph Prince and all these other Christian ministers rejected, because they were trapped in the matriarchal system of let's all get along, love each other, kumbaya, instead of dealing with the truth. And the thing is, they hated the messengers of truth, because the messengers of truth came first at them to confront them about their own matriarchal ways, before confronting anybody else. And they said, no, how dare you question us? And because of that, there is no bridge, and there is no America to rescue. And I know that the Christians are now doubling down on this idea that America is going to be reborn, and then we're going to go through some pains, and there's going to be a rebirth, and there's a I even heard a Christian prophet, having a vision about that. And I heard the vision,
a dream that he had, or a vision. I'm not sure what it was. And he spoke of this baby that he saw in this wrapped in the American flag, and like America being reborn as a little baby, and all that. And he was shown something from the past as this baby was shown to him. And he didn't realize that he was seeing a baby from the past, but he's so bent on in his heart that America is to come back, that he projected it in his heart and mind to the present. And they still believe there's going to be a revival. And they said, the eclipse is going to be a sign of that. The beginning of a revival. That's what he said in his interpretation of his dream. And the sad thing is that same day, when the revival was about to start, that same day, Donald Trump made this big announcement about the importance of not being radical on abortion, and being willing to compromise. And I said, "Oh, interesting. Nice way to start the revival. Nice way to start that revival. Yes. Oh yeah, definitely. America's coming back. Oh yeah, for sure." Led by a man who's saying that we cannot be radical about abortion. If certain babies, yeah, kill them. Go ahead, kill them. And we have to leave it up to the states. The babies, the fetuses in New York, they can go to hell. The fetuses in California, they can go to hell. The ones in Texas and Florida, as long as there's a governor, the Republican governor will care about them. Well, once Texas is gone, man, to hell with all the fetuses in Texas, and so forth. That's the message that inaugurated the revival that started on the eclipse. That just happened ago. That was such a big that there was that had such big hoopla, instead of people understanding that that eclipse was speaking of the eclipse of the American Empire. They thought it was just this nice meteorological event, or astrological, astro, yeah, astronomic or astrological, whatever event. But it really was about the eclipse of the American Empire, the collapse of the American nation, represented by the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse, and the Key Bridge that America needed to get on was completely ignored. So the regeneration that was supposed to happen didn't happen. So it's ironic that eight men were on the bridge, all Hispanics. Eight meaning being the number of regeneration, and they were doing, this crew of regeneration, of Hispanic regeneration, was not doing nothing but filling potholes when the whole bridge was susceptible to collapse. Thank you very much for listening.